Incoming transmission.
The Klingonese phrase of the day is Bech.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
So, this is a huge victory for the good guys.
Scotty, beam me up.
Resistance is futile.
Live long and prosper.
And welcome to the Computer Resume Podcast, the show covering the entire Star Trek franchise in chronological order for fans new and old. I'm your host, writer-comedian, Mr. Todd A. Davis. Building with Lego minimally, while building mental health to the max. It's Thomas Fletcher! Yeah! How you doing, buddy?
Doing all right, Todd. Yourself?
Oh, I'm doing very well. I gotta say, for anyone out there who's not familiar with you, we sort of crossed paths via the internet, and you came on episode 80, I think it was, back a little over a year ago, October of 2022. You were on to discuss one of the last episodes of Star Trek Enterprise. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, it was the episode Bound where we were kind of exploring the Orions.
Yep.
So that's been quite a while ago now. And, you know, a lot of things have happened narratively, but I've seen through your Instagram feed, Minimal Bricks, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But you've had a lot of stuff going on, a lot of builds. I can tell, I mean, for folks who don't know, we're on Zoom. And the background of Thomas's build space, it looks phenomenal. It looked great the first time we recorded. Now it's just kind of like, is he in a TV studio? This looks amazing.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's you kind of, I'm going to sound like a tourist here, but like the wife and I have gotten into Lego Masters and, you know, it's, like most people, I imagine it starts the wheels turning and things like that. And I've picked up a couple of little poly bags of different little sets and stuff like that, just to kind of give my hands something to do and sort of revisit some nostalgia era, you know, for Todd, just to kind of dive back into childhood things a little bit. Although I'm enjoying it so much. And I think now more than ever, it's readily apparent that Lego, yeah, they put age ranges on the box, but let's be honest, it's for everybody, wouldn't you say?
It certainly is. It certainly is for everyone. And their 18 plus line has completely changed the game and how adults view the hobby. The sets that they are putting out are so well designed and so well just accessible to so many Lego fans. I have sets that are four plus, 10 plus, all of the age ranges, but the 18 plus line is truly one that is helping adults see that the hobby can be theirs again. And it really just get into your inner child again and just enjoy something with your hands.
Yeah. And that was one of the things I wanted, because you had two builds that I wanted to ask you about specifically. One was a box build and the other one was a mock build. Sure. Where it's no instructions, you're creating from your existing collection of pieces. Mm-hmm. So the first one I wanted to ask was, you have the big Dark Knight tumbler.
Yes.
I'm a Batman fan going way back. In fact, I was a Batman fan before I was a Star Trek fan. Like, love Batman. And you talked about on your page, you talked about your love for specifically Dark Knight and Chris Nolan's Batman movies.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about what drew you to those movies and in a way to that set, the Tumblr set, that it hit a special place in your heart, I feel
it
like.
Really did.
Take us through a little bit of that.
So I grew up loving Batman all the way from the 1960s. I actually also had the 1960s Batmobile, the the smaller set. And my dad and I just grew up. Well, my dad and I grew up. I grew up. My dad was my father. But overall, the Batman series as a whole, or just show as a whole in this comic book, which is something that my dad and I really had just a shared passion for. He's also the one that got me into Star Trek as well. But when it comes to the Christopher Nolan films, those were actually films that I really enjoyed because I really just appreciated Christian Bale's portrayal of Batman and Bruce Wayne. Ah. I feel that he brought a different kind of charisma to the character. But when it comes to The Dark Knight and Heath Ledger's portrayal of just a Joker, it really puts you in a position of realizing, and anyone who knows my page knows I am very, very big on mental health. Just when it comes to looking at this villains, you really get an idea that the Joker is an individual with a lot of mental health concerns and a history of mental health. And I really feel that Heath Ledger's just character, the way that he portrayed this Joker, really hit on that in just incredible way. And I also really like how it gave the most believable at the time. There's a debate whether or not Robert Pattinson's Batman did this a little bit better. The most believable Batman towing the line of what he's going to do with the Joker. And my sister and I also just really enjoyed watching that movie together. It was back when we had DVDs and Blu-rays, and we would just put it into the disc drive over and over again and just continue to watch and rewatch the movie. And the set itself, when I first just saw it, I said, that's way, way too expensive. I'm not going to buy it. I'm not going to have a place to put it. But I ended up just getting it, and it's actually one of my top five sets that I own now. It's wow. One that I will never sell. I will never part out. I will never give away, just because it has a lot of just nostalgia, and I'm really attached to just a Nolan storyline of Batman. I wish there were more movies, but I'm also happy with how they tied everything up. I think they did a pretty good job with it too.
Yeah, I was actually talking about the Chris Nolan Batman movies here recently with someone, and we were making the comparison of how the whole vibe of the Christopher Nolan trilogy to the Robert Pattinson the Batman movie as it stands alone currently. And I was also talking with them about the movie Seven from 1995, I think. Yeah. Morgan Freeman, Brad Pitt. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of this gritty, bit nihilistic, well, very nihilistic, detective, noir, murder mystery thing. And they were, everybody where I was talking with them, they were familiar with the Robert Pattinson Batman, but none of them had seen Seven. I said, if you like, I turned into the Netflix suggestion. I was like, if you like the Batman, you should really watch Seven. And to be honest, that's not a, I'm not breaking new ground here. Like, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, the Batman is clearly modeled after Seven, like very much. But we were also talking about Heath Ledger's Joker. And I don't know if you stumbled across this, but did you ever see Patton Oswalt, the comedian Patton Oswalt, his theory on who the Joker is, like prior to the movie? Did you ever see that?
No. I'm very, very interested to hear about it.
I don't want to like totally let the cat out of the bag because Patton Oswalt is an amazing writer. But I will say that you're absolutely right. He's got a lot of mental health issues that he is either dealing with or playing with, because I think there's definitely two sides to that coin for sure. To not necessarily to make a two-faced pun, but there you go. The Patton Oswalt basically says his theory is that Joker was a CIA interrogator. Which kind of lends to everything that he does throughout the movie, playing on people's fears, playing on people's emotions. The equipment that he uses is very like quick, dirty DIY, like duct tape this thing to this thing. And it's a remote trigger, but it's basically wired off of a cell phone or wired off of a walkie-talkie, like bare minimum type stuff. And he brings the city to its knees with it. And it's kind of like, whoa, of course, the scars on his face, he gives everybody a different story. So nobody has the same story. And when it comes to the interrogation scene between him and Batman, between him and Jim Gordon first and then Batman, yeah. You kind of look at that whole thing and he plays both of them. And then even the cop that they leave in there to watch him, like he plays that guy too. Like he totally plays him. Yeah. Anyways, we are going to talk about Star Trek.
Yes.
But before we get to that, the other build that I wanted to ask you about is your mock build. And I think it's pretty much at the top of your feed on Instagram is your Sith Cathedral. It's this kind of, I'm going to try to do it justice here, but it's an all black church.
Yes.
That is kind of modeled. Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong. It looks like it's modeled off of Notre Dame. Is that rough?
Yeah.
Roughly
yes.
Correct. Okay, cool. But it's done in all black and all the little minutiae around it, it screams Star Wars. So it becomes this Sith temple. Mm-hmm. And it is gorgeous. It is amazing.
Thank you. I really appreciate hearing that.
Yeah. Thank you. It's so, and again, as someone who knows very little, I was very, very impressed. I was like, okay, where's more pictures of this thing? it's incredible. And to be honest, I had the thought until I saw a picture, I was like, I wonder if he put any of the pieces from the tumbler into that build. But then you had a picture of it, and in the back, I could see the tumbler. I was like, okay, he didn't touch the tumbler for this thing.
Not at all. But yeah,
talk to me a little bit about the inspiration for that and what it was like putting it together. And then once you had it together and took it to shows, like, walk me through the whole thing, man. It's awesome.
Yeah. So I am someone who loves castles. I love fantasy, which is why I also have the affinity for Star Wars, because it is, for all intents and purposes, just space fantasy. So I thought, what a great way for me to kind of merge my love for just fantasy, just in general. And I said, I would like to make a medieval Star Wars mashup build. I thought, what am I able to do that would tell a clear story, paint a clear picture to someone looking at like a picture of it or at a convention or at a show? Will they be able to get the story? And my whole inspiration behind it actually came from, I was watching Rogue One, and it's when you see Darth Vader's castle for the first time in all of its glory. And I thought, how cool would it be if I took the idea of a church or like a temple, and I came up with the idea of the Sithstein Cathedral? Because I just thought it would just be just a lot of fun to build. The concept really just came from late at night, I was just fiddling around with some pieces, and I built one of the turrets or like the towers for it. And I said, this could be part of the build. And then I built the other side, and then I built the middle, and then I built the base. And before I knew it, I was on the Lego world. We have a website called Bricklink, and I was on Bricklink, going to all of the different secondhand stores and buying as many black pieces as I was able to find. I'm actually one of the stores, I actually sold them out of black cheese slopes twice. But what's interesting about the build is I only brought it to one show, and then I brought it home and decided that I wanted the pieces for another build. So I actually no longer have that piece built anymore. Which goes a little bit into my view on Lego, because as a kid, I would build these things and I would just take them apart right away. And that's just something that is still with me as an adult. Not a lot of my builds have a long shelf life.
Yeah. To be honest, because I mean, in looking at it, like I said, it was giving me Notre Dame vibes. And so I wanted to ask you, because there's a lot of things that people have ideas for. It's like, oh, to build this in Lego and all that stuff. And you're like, oh, they've got to have a set for that. But like, it's surprising, as many Lego sets as there are, how many things are not in Lego, speaking of Star Trek.
That's a whole separate conversation.
Yes, it is. But looking at, what you did with that cathedral, did you pull any references? Because it looks photo accurate. Like it looks like it's an official thing. It looks so good, dude.
I really appreciate that. I just looked at a picture of Notre Dame and I thought, I think it would be cool to try to build that. So with me, whenever I build anything, I always think of just symmetry. How will I be able to build this in a way to save time, to save space, to save money? So what would happen is I actually built it like in sections.
Yeah.
So it was actually completely modular. And when it was shipped to a Chicago to Brick World, I actually built it in those pieces. And I would build one side and I would just figure out like what pieces will I need for the next. So I actually went like a few weeks between each side of the build, just because I really wanted to get the scale right. I really wanted to make sure that I took time on each side. If you go down a little bit more in my page, you actually see a few of the techniques that I used. I did not document it as well as I wish I did. I was actually talking to someone about this build yesterday or like a couple days ago with a friend, and I just kicked myself because there were so many details of how I built it. I wish that I would have documented well enough, because I don't want to sound too just boastful, but I was actually kind of impressed with what I was able to get accomplished.
Yeah.
With very, very little experience, because that was actually that's actually the largest thing I've actually ever built.
I don't want it to sound like I'm just blowing smoke. It's really impressive. And to be honest, and scrolling back through, because you mentioned the idea of the medieval fantasy combined with Star Trek, or excuse me, with Star Wars. Wars. Yeah. Oh, they'll take my podcast away. You also have sort of a Bespin floating cloud build. Do you still have that? Is that...
So no, I actually needed those slopes for another smaller build.
Okay.
That I needed. So yes, that was my first medieval Star Wars build. I did the Bespin duel, but I did it with just floating, just almost like just like a floating castle in the clouds, which that was a lot of fun to build. That was actually the second piece I ever took to a show. And that was a lot of fun. Probably my favorite thing to build on that was actually Boba Fett's dragon.
Yes. That's such a great detail. I love it.
I actually realized I actually built that about a couple weeks before I went to the show, because I said it needs something that will call like attention to like, this is a Star Wars build, because I just kept Boba Fett just the helmet. But what I love about the mashup is I was so easily able to use the Star Wars figures as medieval figures. I don't want to get too much into Star Wars and the characters I used in it. This is Star Trek podcast.
This is a safe place to explore all fandoms.
But I use the Inquisitors, and I didn't have to do much with them, like at all, because they look like they're medieval figures. So
yeah, yeah. And I was
hope I answered your questions.
Yeah, it, you know, there was, and again, and then we'll move on. But I, just to toot your horn just a little bit more, that waterfall coming off.
I stared
at that waterfall for a while. I was just like,
I really appreciate it.
I was like, look at this thing. It looks like a waterfall. Like that's always the thing with Legos and, you know, looking at certain things. It's just like, oh man, that's for whatever reason, the scale's not right. And it doesn't look at that. And what it just, I get what they're going for, but it just doesn't look right. But like, dude, I mean, it's so beautiful. Anyways, in addition to all of your Lego building, sounds like you've been keeping up with Star Trek as much as you can. Of course, amidst the pandemic and the strike, you know, sort of pressing pause on the franchise for a few moments, understandably and with good reason. But now that that's behind us, we're still kind of waiting for, Discovery season 5. And of course, Strange New Worlds season 3 next year.
I can't believe we're already on season 3 of Strange New Worlds. Like, where'd that come from?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, when the wife and I leave the house, we usually end up putting on Next Generation for our dog. Yeah, it's got great music. And let's be honest, you'd listen to 7 seasons of just Patrick Stewart, like telling people to engage. Like, it's it's wonderful. But looking at the structure of the Next Gen era, the Berman era, or whatever, or the Legacy era, whatever you want to call it. You know, 26 episodes a season, that's a hell of a lot of television. And then when you look at the stuff streaming, season 1, season 2 of Strange New Worlds, 10 episodes each, but they're so packed.
Mm-hmm.
They are packed to the rafters with plot, story, character development. Some of the most amazing special effects, mm-hmm. arguably on TV today.
Yes.
What was it like? Because we haven't talked about Strange New Worlds with you yet. What was it like, if you recall, your first viewing of Strange New Worlds?
It was actually, for me, it was actually pretty emotional. Actually really, really took it in as this opportunity to see... there's a character that was reintroduced in Discovery really take shape, Pike.
Yes.
I remember watching TOS, the original series, and just so is like curious about Pike. Mm. Like who is this person in the pilot who was a little sexist? We don't talk about that.
The franchise, the franchise has come a long way.
Oh, it very much has. Sorry, I don't know why I decided to throw that in there. But I just remember that episode thinking like, not quite what we're going for now. But I'm not saying that Pike is sexist. But and then you see him in Spock's trial. I believe that was the name of the episode. I can't remember. Please,
The Menagerie.
The Menagerie. I don't know why it's Spock. Wow. But the Menagerie, like, who is this just captain? And then we get another taste of him in the the Chris Pine Star Trek movies.
Bruce Greenwood.
Yeah. But so who we have now playing Pike, watching just a character unfold, I believe he truly represents what Gene Roddenberry wanted Star Trek captain to be.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We've spent a significant portion of our discussion here on the podcast of season 1 of Strange New Worlds, and a buddy of mine, Patrick Cunningham, made the comparison, and boy, did it hit home with me. He gets all the Captain America speeches, and he literally does. But another thing that we explored in another episode is that Pike is a builder. He is a builder of crews, of his crew, not only as a crew, but as individuals. And I have some questions about this later on, but I'm just going to preface it with this here, that the Pike has certainly changed from the Cage to Strange New Worlds. That much is very clear. And yeah, Anson Mount is just knocking it out of the park. But but with this particular episode, we see him faced with a pretty tough decision and a heavy, heavy dilemma of this particular planet, how they do things. They're not in the Federation. What is his responsibility? And all of these things kind of coming together in one moment. And you see the horror on his face when he realizes the totality of circumstances. Before we get into any sort of spoiler territory, do you have any general overarching thoughts about how this plays out and, you know, the dilemma that is presented here before we get into spoiler territory? Any thoughts?
So are you asking about the dilemma that is just presented to Pike in this moment?
Yeah, it's kind of a hard question to answer without getting into spoilers.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose what I would say is that this, I think the best way that I can put it is this really defines what the Prime Directive is, what General Order 1 really means, and why it's so difficult for captains to follow it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you also mentioned before we chatted a little bit before the episode started, but you also mentioned that this is kind of the perfect example of what Star Trek is, and that we're taking really heavy topics and, you know, cloaking them in science fiction. Any thoughts to that before we get into the recap?
So I would just say the one thing I've always loved about Star Trek is I'm not gonna say the best episodes, but my favorite episodes for me personally are the ones that really make me go, huh, or make me or put me in a position of truly reflecting on what I would do in that situation. And I remember, I can tell you that when I finished this episode, I have a friend who also watches Star Trek, not at the same time, but we always like to reflect on it. As soon as I finished this episode, I sent him a text and said, "This is the best episode I've ever seen. You have to sit down and watch it." And he was instantly just skeptical. But about 2 hours later, I get a text from him and he just says, "Holy sh-," because it truly just blew his mind that they were able to write an episode in a way where the child was the main character or like the main subject matter, but it wasn't a kid's episode.
Right.
It wasn't like in TNG where the science fair winners were in the elevator with Picard. The turbo lift. This is a very, very serious episode that I don't think the writer wanted to be taken lightly.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is so much to unpack with this episode, and it can be very easy to dismiss it as, oh, just another, oh, what adventure are we getting into this week? You know, but there is some really, really heavy stuff going on here. So I can tell that both of us really want to dive in. So before we go, yeah. So before we get any further, let's get to this week's recap. Brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, Rev J, Jerry Antimano, Cosmic Crit, Kitty B, David Willett, Ed Milner, Fleet Admiral First Class Fred Sims, and Ren, Space Monkey 73, and Steph Overman.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Let's go meet our guests.
Pipe? You know her?
Your new uniform is very yellow.
And gold, technically, because I'm a captain.
First servant is a whole new child. Everyone on Majalis is his family.
I bet I could generate my own subspace frequency.
That would be an impressive feat.
The boy is in great danger. There's no one I can trust.
Red alert! What the hell is going on?
If the first servant doesn't ascend, we'll be destroyed.
While en route to the planet Majelis, Enterprise receives a distress call from a shuttlecraft under attack from a warship.
Sucks!
Enterprise destroys the warship, and the shuttlecraft personnel are transported aboard.
Whoa, that was close.
There's a boy called the First Servant, his father and physician, Gamal, and Alora, a leader on Majelis, who's an old flame of Pike's.
Oh my.
Pike agrees to return them to Majelis. Gamal attempts to fake his son's death to keep him from returning to the planet, but is thwarted, and the boy goes to Majelis with Pike and Alora for his ascension ceremony.
Yeah, right.
Pike is allowed to witness the ceremony, where the corpse of the previous First Servant is removed from a machine, and the new First Servant is connected in his place.
Sucks!
Pike's understandably horrified by this, but unable to stop it. And Alora explains that Majelis can only remain a paradise-like society if a child is sacrificed to the machine.
Great.
Majelis' rebellious colony objects to this practice, and Gamal had joined them to save his son. Gamal helps Mbengo work on a treatment for Rukia's condition, then leaves Enterprise to join the colony, hoping to save the future First Servants.
And there was much rejoicing.
What pop culture melodies make your Mondays magical? Is it the soundtrack or score to a mainstream movie? How about shows like Goosebumps or The X-Files? Maybe it's this little ditty. You can get all these and more from Enjoy the Ride Records. Enjoy the Ride Records is a Long Island, New York-based record label, specializing in cult-following reissues throughout a variety of genres, working with a group of diverse licensing partners throughout the entertainment industry to help create albums in a unique, limited-release format since 2008. Enjoy the Ride Records collaborates with companies and artists alike to ensure a quality product is created using the highest quality audio and artwork sources available. Right now, Computer Resume podcast listeners save 10% on Star Trek The Motion Picture, the Director's Edition, music composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith, by using the coupon code ComputerResumePod exclusively at enjoytheriderecords.com. And Computer Resume Podcast Patreon supporters at the $10 level or higher will get a special code for an additional 15% off. That's right, a total of 25% off the motion picture score just for being a Patreon supporter. So what are you waiting for? Go to patreon.com and sign up before the end of April 15th, 2024 to get your code while supplies last. And remember, no matter what you're listening to or where you're going, enjoy the ride.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Gordon, okay, the voice of the USS Protostar
right
on Star Trek Prodigy.
Things are
you are listening to the Computer Resume podcast.
Because they attack the Enterprise and they're just kind of like, did that hurt at all? What are they doing? But once they're aboard, we see like, oh, Pike's got a bit of a romantic past here. We see this connection with Alora. And we're getting some very heavy static from the dad, from the physician, this Gamal. Let's start with first impressions of Alora, Gamal, and this child who seems to be brilliant beyond any previous encounter with someone their age.
When I first saw the episode, I was actually a little bit concerned it was going to be kind of like an old flame, like rekindling kind of episode, kind of like a classic, I'm like Riker kind of situation. And I was actually, so at first that's what I thought it was going to be, but very, very quickly it got into a very, very serious level of conversation about what was just going on. But most definitely, I would say that what really just struck me was that there was this child who was instantly on the platform as well. That also just really caught my just overall like attention.
In looking at how this child has been raised and clearly a genius, I mean, even from a television production standpoint, this kid is firing off some heavy, heavy technobabble, which Star Trek fans know episodes of the franchise are kind of known for their technobabble. And even like seasoned veteran actors are just like, you got to approach it like Shakespeare because it doesn't make sense. These things aren't real. But this kid is just like, oh, like, whoa.
So it was like definitely clear that the kid was portraying a very just gifted individual.
Yeah, absolutely. And in my life and in my goings about in different circles and things like that, I've seen some overbearing parents, some overprotective parents, and to a point where it's just kind of like, okay, maybe cut the umbilical cord. Eventually they're going to have to stand on their own two feet. Like, when do you do that? I it's easy for me to say that, my wife and I don't have any kids together. So it's just kind of like, you know, as an outsider looking in, that's kind of how it looks like. But, you know, I look at your interactions with your daughter on your page, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but you've posted a couple things about how you play with your daughter and Legos and that you aren't so, it's more about the time with her rather than like getting the build right or whether or not the build stays together. Like, can you talk a little bit about your relationship as juxtaposed with this boy, the first servant, and the father, Gamal?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one thing that I'm, when it comes to my daughter and Lego, is I'm really trying to bring her alongside the journey of creativity. I really want her to have an understanding that Lego in and of itself, even the sets that we buy, they're an accumulation of pieces that can be put together and then taken apart and reused. We actually, one thing I've always said to her, no matter if it's one of my models that I have on a shelf or if it's a build that we just decided to put together at my desk here, whenever anything breaks, I just say to her, it's okay, we can build it again. Like, it's not that big of a deal, because I want her to understand, like, this is what Lego is meant for. And when I look at Gamal and his son, he is bringing up this very intelligent person. For one reason or another, we haven't gotten there yet in the show, but it really comes to the fact of that there was this very, very serious nurturing aspect of who Gamal was to this child. And that's really how I view what I do with my daughter and Lego, is I really want her to have this clear understanding that Lego is a creative tool. And it can be used to build and create just incredible things. And I've seen her already build some pretty awesome stuff.
Yeah. And if I can, again, as an outsider looking in, from your perspective, that was the thing that kind of struck me. And I guess it would apply more to the adults of like, we're not guaranteed tomorrow. Like, eventually she's not going to be here asking to play Lego with me, to build with me. So I'm going to take every opportunity. And again, as just an outsider looking in, it warms my heart to see that. I absolutely adore you guys. And she's so adorable.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And looking at what Gamal is willing to do for his son, in that he's willing to fake his son's death, which does, I mean, you see the look of horror on his face when he gets back and it's like, where's my kid?
Yeah.
The mental state. And of course, knowing that he actually facilitated this.
Yeah.
So he had to put himself in the state of mind of, okay, I'm just not, my son is safe, but I'll never see him again. I mean, what that has to do to someone, to a parent, I, I have a friend on, you know, who's another Trek fan whose child is currently undergoing a lot of life-threatening medical issues. This is part of where I was like, I wish I could help or be involved somehow. But to see the toll that it takes on a parent physically, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, a laundry list of ways that this affects someone. Can you even put yourself in that position of what this would do to, maybe not you, but what this does to a person who has to endure this kind of society decision-making process? I'm clearly not good at putting this together in a cohesive question, but let's talk a little bit about the mental health or lack of mental health, depending on your point of view, of mm-hmm. Gamal as a parent. Mm-hmm.
So I you actually brought up a great point, because I don't think that is just something that like a first time on looker of the episode would see, even once you get and they realize what has just happened. But when they are transported away, then immediately brought back, and he goes, "Where is the first servant?" At that point, you know, Gamal was probably like, "I'm never going to see my son again," because the whole idea was, he was safe. Yeah. He was with those who were going to keep him safe, where they want all the other first servants to go. And that's really what I really just value as just a parent. I don't know if I could ever abandon my daughter even to safety. I mean, like, that's the hard thing, yeah. You know, because if I were to ever get into that situation where it meant like abandoning her for her to be safe, I can't imagine the kind of mental gymnastics that Gamal had to do to allow himself to accept that, hey, he's never going to see his kid again. Because in the eyes of the culture, he was a first servant first and his son second. So either way, he was going to live without his son one way or another.
Yeah.
Either way, he was going to lose his son. And in the end, he did. So I think that what Gamal had to go through, I'm not even sure if there's, I don't think there's a parent out there who would be able to function. And I think that when it gets to the end of the episode, he's kind of like, well, I'm going to go ahead and help other first like servants. I think that plays a little bit into the culture of acceptance of, well, my son's gone, but maybe I can help like another child in the future. But there was almost like an ambivalence once he realized what happened to his son. And that might be a little bit of a harsh thing for me to say, but that's kind of how I am with this. I'm like, took it. There was kind of like an ambivalence just after he realized that his son was gone.
Yeah. And so, you know, you mentioned the culture and it brought to mind, they mentioned that the first servant is chosen through a lottery. Mm-hmm. So it's not a question of class or financial status or anything. It's your child is chosen. That's it. So it makes me think of different societies. And I won't spend a lot of time on this because I haven't delved into enough different cultures in our own world that I would feel comfortable speaking knowledgeably about it. But looking at not only how, and there's not even really a typical American family to say, well, this is how we raise our kids. But like when you juxtapose this country with the UK, with Africa, South America, Canada, even, and all the different societal, cultural things of how we bring up children and what parents are or aren't willing to do for their children. I mean, even in light of the haves and the have-nots, and it brings so many thoughts to mind of, well, how would this impact you know, a family that has, you know, a truckload of kids versus a family that they only had the one child.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
You know, it brings to mind so many different things of how this could be approached. And this kind of leads into my next question here, the next topic of discussion really, is that while we're looking at Gamal and his mental health and having to deal with all this, we as the audience aren't following them. We're actually following Pike and the crew of the Enterprise. So let's talk about Pike for a second. And I've already mentioned that Pike is kind of a builder. He's a builder of the crew, not only as a crew, but as individuals as well. Mm-hmm. And he is dedicated. We saw that from when he had to grab the time crystal, like just touching it, he knew his fate. But we saw his resolve come back and he's like, I have to do this. It's at this point, my fate is irrelevant. We're talking about all sentient life. Give me that crystal. Bam. He did the right thing. And it was you could tell it was hard for him to do that. And even the beginning of Strange New Worlds, especially early on, we see him still struggling with the idea of like, I know my fate. Can I escape it? Should I escape it? Will I escape it? But here, that almost takes a back seat to his view of the Federation, mm-hmm, and their stance on interacting with other cultures. General Order 1, the Prime Directive. Magellus is not part of the Federation. He has no claim to enforce any rules or any laws in this particular society. Now he takes some liberties of like, hey, you came to us for help, so we are obligated to XYZ. But again, like, he sees the horror of what is going on Magellus. And has to say, okay, we're out. Sorry. Like, and he's like, are you going to tell the Federation? Like, oh, you bet your ass. Yeah, I'm going to let the Federation know what I've seen here today. For sure. Oh, and by the way, lose my number. Like, he's out. He 86 Pike gone. He doesn't even say goodbye. He's just like, all right, done here. Whoop, gone. Yep. So, you know, but Pike, as a builder, and you as a builder, knowing that things can fall apart, mm-hmm, how do you think Pike feels about General Order 1 in light of the practices going on Magellus?
Well, I actually think that we can backtrack a little bit to Pike was actually part of uncovering where the First Servant went to in the first place.
Yes.
Like, so he was actually part of helping Allura solve the mystery of where the First Servant was. And he was even like skeptical of why, it's just a kid. Like, a kid can't like bear the weight of an entire civilization. So I think that Pike was doing more than wrestling with General Order Number 1. He was wrestling with the fact that he condemned this child.
Yeah.
That his very efforts of helping out, which he didn't violate the Prime Directive by, well, it wasn't known as a Prime Directive then, not quite yet, General Order 1. So before we even get to him wrestling with General Order 1, we have to accept the fact that he actually helped Allura get the First Servant back. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably what he wrestled with the most, I would think. Because he was like, I'm going to go tell Starfleet. Like, I don't care. Like, I'm going to do whatever I can. But overall, I really wish that there was an episode where Pike was unpacking this. Yeah. It would be really, really just helpful for us to see how he deals with it. Like, this is where I wish there was like a short treks of him with like a ship's counselor or something.
Yes.
You know, like, I think that would be great. Like, I would sit down and watch a therapy session between a ship's counselor and
Paramount Plus. You've heard us. Please bring back short treks. We need them.
I think that would be great. But I definitely feel that in terms of General Order 1, I would probably say that Pike is conflicted as any other captain would be. Because this really gets into the area of where do you draw the line? Because one thing we were discussing about before is, you know, it's kind of like the, well, like a discussion that my friends and I had, well, it's one child over an entire civilization.
Yeah.
Not saying that I agree, because Picard would say that he would refuse to allow arithmetic to answer such a question.
Yeah.
Because Data asks Picard the same question, would you choose one life over 1,000? And that's what Picard says. And I think that Pike is probably having like a similar, like there's no right answer here.
Right. Yeah.
And that's where I also kind of just struggle with it too, is one, I would be trying to rescue the first servant, but I'm also not part of that culture.
Right. Yeah.
Because Alora, I feel that I could see Alora really, really struggling with it herself, but there's also the acceptance of, we don't understand why they built it this way, but this is just what we do. And Pike's like, you don't want to come up with a different idea? Like,
You've got all this other technology. Well, first of all, let's back up. Nobody knows what this machine does or how it works. Really?
Or
nobody
what left it up. Does. Or what it does to the child inside of it.
Yeah.
No one really knows.
Like, nobody left a post-it note to just be like, hey, by the way, this is what the machine does. And again, like, their medical technology alone is far superior to what the Federation has. At least that's the vibe we get from.
And Gamal refused to help Mbenga with his daughter.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, that's a whole other level of conversation, whether it's like, Gamal, like, come on, dude. Like, you can't help out a sick child, but
yeah,
like, you're part of this culture that kills children.
Oh, like, yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's, yeah, it short circuits my brain. I'm just like, what? But the thing,
Well, see, and what's even odd about that is, Gamal has a disdain for his culture, yet he's going to hold so close to his culture's principles to not help someone.
Yeah.
So that gets back into his mental health and his own struggles with the world that he knows and the world that he wants for his son.
Right. Because it makes me think of like, okay, Pike's going to go back and tell the Federation.
What's
the Federation going to say? Because I mean, if Magellus is in a position to be beneficial to the Federation in terms of trade routes or strategic military outposts or something like that, do you think the Federation would care that they sacrifice one child to keep the planet? Because the Federation's not going to do that. Federation's not going to sacrifice one kid, but if, hey, this is their culture and that's what they do.
You know what? I would love to be sitting on the Federation Council while they're discussing this, and also be a fly on the wall of admirals to discussing this, because I'm sure they would have an interesting debate. Because would they refuse aid to this culture? Because they are known to help non-Federation worlds.
Oh, yeah.
Would they refuse aid to this culture? I would hope not.
Yeah.
That's just me. I would hope not. But I really think that we need more episodes about this episode.
Yes. I was just about to say, I hate to say, I disagree. I don't think we need one short trek. We need like a dozen short treks to unpack all of the stuff going on in this episode, man.
Because it's so great.
It is so a doozy. Great. Yeah, it's a doozy, really, for sure. We've kind of danced around it a little bit, but we see Pike lose a connection to a romantic partner.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think this affects him moving forward, knowing that he also has the relationship with Captain Batel?
Ooh. Well, first of all, I would say because I mentioned a little bit about how he was probably already just kicking himself for even helping them in the first place, because the reason that he was, I feel, so quick to help was because of Alora. Right. So his love connection actually aided in causing some suffering for this child. Some could argue. I'm not sure if I'm arguing that, but I think that some could argue that. But when it comes to his relationship, I guess present relationship with Captain Batel, we've already kind of seen some tension there, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. Some more and some more coming down the line, too.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see that unfold because Pike strikes me as the ideal captain.
Mm.
But I don't quite have an answer to how it's going to affect his future relationships. I really think the writers have a major task ahead of them.
Yeah, I think when you look at the totality of the life of Captain Pike, and I'm not talking about just to this point, I'm talking about from what we know from the cage,
yep,
through Discovery Season 2, mm-hmm, through the first two seasons of Strange New Worlds, knowing the potential risk,
mm-hmm,
that Pike and Batel are in at the end of Season 2. I don't want to jump too far ahead. I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to put the cart too far in front of the horse here. But even in Subspace Rhapsody, they're having issues over where to go on vacation. And at the beginning of Strange New Worlds, Season 1, like, he lets the beard grow and she's like, hey, you gonna, you know, maybe take a shower today and get back out there, Captain? Like, and so
I like, you can see, beard.
I do too. I think he looks great with the beard as a dude who sports a beard myself. But yeah, looking at how he interacts with Batel prior to this episode and knowing how he is moving forward, I think this may have, it may be a case of like once bitten, twice shy, and which is a dangerous spot to be in for somebody like Pike, who's already kind of on the fence. For a guy his age, you would think he would be past a lot of the social game plays of like dating life, of just kind of like, hey, just be honest that you don't want to go to this resort with her, that you'd rather go camping. No, he decides to lie about it. Like, what are you doing? Don't do that. Just be honest. And, you know, you see a lot of, I know my wife and I have a fairly extensive circle of friends who are all in various relationships, and those relationships are in various states of mm-hmm, existence. And we've had a couple of people say, like, you guys make it look so easy. And we're like, how are we making this look easy? If you think we're making this look easy, please tell us. Like, tell us how. Right,
because we don't know.
Yeah, we have no idea. Like, because my wife and I are very different people. Like, I'm on the mic. She's my executive producer, which means more often than not, she's not on the mic. But she's behind the scenes helping me make decisions that are more suited to her strengths. And she knows when she can rely on me. I know when I can rely on her. And I think that's what a good partnership is. But we can see clearly that Pike either doesn't have that emotional maturity, or he's been so affected by his experiences in Starfleet, be it the cage, or seeing his fate in Discovery, or stuff like this in Strange New Worlds, that Batel might be biting off more than she can chew when it comes to being in a relationship with Pike. This,
well,
he need, like you said, he needs to sit with a counselor for a couple of short treks and work, yeah, some of this stuff out, man.
I think Pike has a sense of duty.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think that probably goes, I don't even need to say that, but I think that is where, that's where the problem is really going to rise. And I'm not going to say anything about anything else because I don't want to get too far ahead of your episodes.
Sure.
but there is a sense of commitment that you see that Pike has to his crew. There's a sense of commitment that Pike has to his ideals as an individual. There was an episode where he says, it is by Federation mandate and my conscience that I must intervene.
Yes.
You know, I can't remember exactly what he said, but I remember very, very clearly he said, and my conscience. I'm like, whoa, that is special. Like, yeah, that's not something you've heard a captain say.
That's true.
So he definitely has a sense of like dignity about the oath that he's taken the Starfleet very, very seriously. And I think that he sees it as an oath to humanity, because even in Discovery, the Admiral, I can't remember her name, said, "We kept you in the dark because you're the best of Starfleet."
Yes. Yes.
So I can go on about
Cornwall. Yeah. Admiral Cornwall.
Yes. Corn.
Loved her. Cornwall. Oh.
And Pike during that moment was just like, thank you. Like, he didn't know what to say. It was like so perfect. Like, it was perfect Pike. Very, very humble. Like, I'm just being a captain. Like, I'm just like doing what I'm supposed to be doing. So I think that's what he's going to run into, is his sense of duty to himself, to his oath, and to his people.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. And we've said, we've already been on here for about an hour trying to unpack this episode, and I feel like we've barely scratched the surface. Yeah. You could explore so many aspects of this episode at great detail. I think there's a lot of probably family counselors, relationship counselors who could probably write theses, anyway, multiple papers about what go. Yeah, there you go. But yeah, there's so many great things to unpack. And in an effort to keep this episode under 6 hours, let's move on. We always champion not only the people in front of the camera, but the folks behind the camera as well. So as we do every episode lovingly, we ask the question, who do we blame? This episode was written by Robin Wasserman and Bill Walkoff. Robin Wasserman's last work in the franchise was the very last episode, season 1, episode 5, Spock Amok, which we discussed last episode with the National Wrestling Alliance's backstage interviewer, Mr. Gary Horn, and also Bill Walkoff. His last work in the franchise was season 1, episode 3, The Ghosts of Illyria, which we discussed with executive producer Kat Davis back on episode 120. Talking about relationships and episodes, what did you think of Spock Amok, just really quickly?
I just really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I think whenever you get into Spock and dealing with his emotions, I just think that you just have a great time.
Oh, yeah. And to be honest, it's kind of I know they've toyed with certain storytelling tropes in other franchise, in other series within the franchise. But this, I felt like, was the first true romantic comedy done in kind of a Freaky Friday type style. You know, the whole body switch. I thought it was really well done. Yeah, we had a great conversation about that.
Just, the acting was great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. And some of the comedic moments in that were handled so well by not only the cast, but the way it was shot. And it's a great discussion about a really great episode. I highly recommend folks check it out. So this episode was also directed by Andy Armaganian. I may be pronouncing that incorrectly. Please forgive me. But earlier in her career, she worked as an editor on a few DC Comics properties, such as the Aquaman TV movie back from 2006, which I totally forgot existed, 44 episodes of Smallville, 37 episodes of Arrow, 21 episodes of Supergirl, and 1 episode of Stargirl. And as a director, she would get her name on episodes of The Flash, Arrow, Supergirl, and DC's Legends of Tomorrow. Thomas, do you have an affinity for any one particular comic book company, DC, Marvel, otherwise?
I've really always been more of a Marvel person. I know we spent the start of this episode talking about Batman,
yeah.
But Marvel is most definitely where I've spent a majority of my time, especially. And I really got into Marvel during the Avengers versus X-Men run.
Yes. Oh, that's a great run.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm a Batman fan, but I am more likely to pick up a Marvel book than I am.
You're not the first person to tell me that. And that's probably me too.
It's such an interesting, and of course the history of those companies is fascinating and would take forever to unpack. But I mean, when we spoke with Gary Horn last episode, he went on for a minute about just trying to read a continuity, a cohesive continuity in Marvel, and it's extensive. And knowing that DC was around much longer than Marvel's been, you know, it gets staggering at some point. But yeah, I was a big Batman fan. Like I said, I forgot that the Aquaman TV movie existed. And, you know, when it comes to like the DC movies and stuff like that, like we both professed our love for not only Robert Pattinson in the Batman, but also Chris Nolan's Batman movies. And as well, the 60s series. I was a big fan of Kevin Conroy and the animated series, Mark Hamill. To me, I can't read a Batman comic book and not hear Kevin Conroy's voice. That's actually kind of how I judge how well a Batman comic book is written, is if I can hear Kevin Conroy's voice. But yeah, and DC.
I'm trying to imagine the Dark Knight now.
yeah, you're absolutely right. It's I could fall down that rabbit hole for sure. And the last thing I'll say about the DC stuff is kind of, I know they're trying to stay separate from Marvel, but at some point you would think, hey, you know what? They're printing money over at Disney. Can we maybe do a similar thing and maybe have some cohesiveness to this universe? And like, don't get me wrong, the Flash movie, it wasn't really for me. I get it, and some people liked it, and that's fine. But I was so impressed with the kid that's playing him on TV. I was like, why didn't you just hire that guy? Like, he's doing a great job. Let's just bring him over and just make that movie. But they didn't bother to call Todd Davis and ask his opinion. They
didn't bother to call me either, because I agree with you. The Flash TV show, it's probably up there being probably one of my favorite superhero shows.
And you know, even you know, the ties, of course, to you know Arrow, and you know, there's a handful of other shows that go along within that contained DC TV universe. It's kind of like, oh man, I love to see this on the big screen, but they want to keep them separate. Okay, whatever. Anyways, Andy Armaganian. This is not her first directing in the franchise. Her first directing was actually season 4, episode 9 of Discovery, the episode Rubicon. But of course, we're covering things here chronologically, so we haven't gotten there yet. But needless to say, we will see her name pop up again. And then in terms of guest stars, we've got two that I'd like to explore. First, Elder Gamal, played by Hussein Madhavi. He's born in London, Ontario, Canada, which means he's super friendly. You may have also seen him in an episode of Lethal Weapon, the series from 2017, or an episode of Schitt's Creek that he was in back in 2020. But this is his only work in the franchise so far. And we've both said, gosh, we hope we see these characters again and explore a little bit more of this storyline and where Majelis sits in the franchise, certainly not in the Federation, at least not yet. But anyways, hopefully we get to revisit it. The other actor I would like to give a shout out to is Lindy Booth, who plays Alora. She's also from Canada, Oakville, Ontario, Canada. She played Carrie Taylor for 15 episodes of Eerie Indiana, The Other Dimension. And then 44 episodes as Claudia in the series Relic Hunter. She was in 12 episodes of the famous Jet Jackson as Riley Grant. She also made appearances in, okay, here comes the list, folks. American Psycho 2, Mutant X, Odyssey 5, Wrong Turn, Dawn of the Dead, The 4400, Kick-Ass 2, Supernatural, 42 episodes of The Librarians, where she may or may not have met Rebecca Romijn, and 2 episodes of The Flash. But this is her only work in the franchise so far. And like we said, hope to see her again. We really want to explore these characters in this particular planet's whole thing in the franchise moving forward. So Thomas, now we come to the question that we ask every episode. Is this essential viewing? If somebody is sitting down and working their way through Star Trek for the very first time, and they come to this episode, Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach, is this a must-see episode, or is this one that they can skip?
I would honestly say if you want to get a really good idea of Pike's character, if you want to get a really good idea of what Star Trek is all about, this is an episode you have to watch.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. You know, part of what I have been looking at when examining each episode through the lens of this question is not only the story within the myriad of stories of the franchise, but also the different character arcs. And I think you're absolutely right. If you're on a Captain Pike track, this is pivotal. We get to see him have to make some really tough decisions. But also, and I don't think I've examined an episode in this particular light before, but this is, like you said, a quintessential Star Trek episode discussing heavy, heavy topics through the lens of science fiction. That's what Star Trek is all about. So yeah, I think this is a must-see episode for sure. Now, we've been coupling this question, the is this essential viewing, with another question that I'll pose to you here. Strange New Worlds, the series Strange New Worlds. Do you think it is a good jumping on point for someone who has never seen Star Trek before?
I would say yes. I would honestly say yes, just because of its anthological approach. It leaves you with a lot of questions of why is Pike so concerned about like his future, which can get you to want to watch even more of Star Trek. I think that there's a lot that is just going on in Strange New Worlds that can really springboard you into even more his viewership.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, looking at this episode and how it stands, you know, I feel like this is a very accessible episode in that you don't necessarily have to have a lot of background to watch and enjoy this episode, because there's not a lot of like, oh, well, you have to know previously three episodes or anything like that. But looking at the series as a whole, as it stands thus far, the two seasons that we've got, they do a good job of recapping just enough so that you understand the stakes and where things are and how they are moving forward within a given narrative. So I think, yeah, I think Strange New Worlds is a great jumping on point for folks. Well, Thomas, thank you so much for taking the time and, you know, sitting with me and nerding out over our mutual love of Star Trek and Lego. I've been getting more pumped about Lego, but re-diving into your feed and talking with you here tonight, like I'm ready to go just click some things together, man. Like it's so much fun.
I love it. Love it.
Do you have any parting thoughts before we go about the episode, about the series Strange New Worlds, about the franchise as a whole, about another experience here on the Computer Resume podcast? Any parting thoughts before we go?
I would just say that if you continue watching Star Trek, just make the journey just a part of your life and just really allow Star Trek to read you a little bit and just provide a lot of just reflection on what it means to be human. Because I think that's what Star Trek does a lot of for me.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much. Well, folks, in 2 weeks, we will be joined by the Trek Queen of New York City, Flip Kiki. We'll be back on the mic to discuss Strange New Worlds, Season 1, Episode 7, The Serene Squall, which is available exclusively on Paramount Plus. Thomas, where can people find you on the interwebs and check out your builds and support what you've got going on and find encouragement through Minimal Bricks?
So it would just be my handle on Instagram. As right now, it's the only place where you can find me, and it's just at Minimal Bricks.
And I am at Mr. Todd A. Davis on all of the socials. From all of us at the Computer Resume podcast, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you at Trek Long Island 2, baby, the sequel. We'll be right back.
support us on Patreon and like, rate, review, and share on all your favorite platforms. Feel free to send us your subspace transmissions to computerresumepodcasts@gmail.com or at Computer Resume on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. The Computer Resume podcast was created and produced by Mr. Todd A. Davis. Our logo was designed by Will Martin and Justin Bishop. The opening theme was produced by Justin Bishop, and our outro music was provided with permission by Dronode. Additional music was provided by Mr. Todd A. Davis and Gary Horn, and the voice of Computer Resume Podcast and executive producer, me, Kat Davis. Hashtag LLAP. We'll see you next time.
Going through a Star Trek. We're doing Star Trek stuff in space. We probably got some phasers and shuttle pods, and we're gonna find a brand new race.
How's that for a slice of fried gold?